You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 164, Paul's Ascent and Angelic Torments with David Burnett. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Pretty good. Busy week. Got some things ahead of me coming up as far as speaking, but it's all fun. It's all good.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, I'm always excited to hear what you and David are going to talk about, so I'm ready for this one.
Yeah, so am I. Well, it's great to have David Burnett back on the podcast with us. David, I'm sure the audience is going to enjoy whatever you present to us. And this time we're going to sort of retread a bit of familiar territory. We've done an episode where we got into 2 Corinthians 12, Paul's experience, I guess, as broadly as we could put it, and the reference to the messenger of Satan harassing him and him pleading with the Lord about it. So we've traversed this a little bit, but when you contacted me about, you had done some recent research on it, and we're sort of following certain trajectories, I was more than interested. So why don't you just get us into it? I know you'll probably want to read the passage first, and then I'll just let you lead the podcast, and I'll jump in from time to time. So go ahead.
Sounds good. Good to talk with you guys again. Well, the passage I'm dealing with today is 2 Corinthians 12, 1 through 10, and Paul's ascent to heaven. Pretty enigmatic passage, and I know you had covered it before. Basically, I'll be reading from the ESV. To get the context of the passage, it's important to frame it in the discourse that Paul frames it in, which is the context of what scholars call the fool's discourse, or the fool's speech. And so I'm going to start up in chapter 11, verse 16, and just read all the way down. So if you'll just bear with me. Mm-hmm. And I may skip a few verses if I need to, but I think it's necessary to set up sort of the context of the ascent, because it'll be critical to my argument. So Paul says, "I repeat, let no one think me foolish. But even if you do, accept me as a fool, so that I too may boast a little. What I am saying with this boastful confidence, I say not as the Lord would, but as a fool. Since many boast according to the flesh, I too will boast. For you gladly bear with fools, being wise yourselves. For you bear it if someone makes slaves of you, or devours you, or takes advantage of you, or puts on airs, or strikes you in the face. To my shame, I must say, we were too weak for that. But whatever anyone dares to boast of, I am speaking as a fool, I also dare to boast of that. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they offspring of Abraham? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I am a better one. I am talking like a madman, with far greater labors, far more imprisonments, with countless beatings, and often near death. 5 times I receive at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes less one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. 1 night and 1 day I was adrift at sea, on frequent journeys in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, in toil and hardship, through many a sleepless night, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. And apart from other things, there is the daily pressure on me of my anxiety for all the churches. Who is weak, and am I not weak? Who is made to fall, and am I not indignant? If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus, he who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. At Damascus, the governor under King Aretas was guarding the city of Damascus in order to seize me. But I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped his hands. And now Paul will go into the ascent. He says, I must go on boasting. Though there is nothing to be gained by it, I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord. I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man was caught up into paradise, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And he heard things that cannot be told, which man may not utter. On behalf of this man, I will boast. But on my own behalf, I will not boast, except of my weaknesses. Though if I should wish to boast, I would not be a fool, for I would be speaking the truth, but I refrain from it, so that no one may think more of me than he sees or hears from me. Sees in me or hears from me. So to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from becoming conceited. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. So that's the passage. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting that you have this in the context of this fool's speech. And well, first, why we call it a fool's speech is it's a rhetorical move by Paul. So instead of the super apostles that are questioning his apostleship, which he's trying to defend here, and whom he's accused to be an ally with Satan, pretty harsh, but he says that instead of boasting in successes, which is what you'd expect, he ends up going to weaknesses. But to start out the whole fool speech, he goes to the identity of identities, the heights of what someone could claim as greatness under the God of Israel is to be a Hebrew, an Israelite, and the seed of Abraham. And even called the servant of the Messiah. So this is in verse 22 and 23 of chapter 11. Now, mm-hmm. The reason why this context is really important is because this is setting up sort of an upside down boasting, right? Because he's saying this is what it means to be a fool, is instead of boasting in these like great, wonderful, you know, things that you would normally boast in, he's boasting in his weaknesses. But he starts with the thing that would be positive, which is being the seed of Abraham, saying, you know, if you would say that, well, so am I. And that's how this whole thing begins before he lists all the horrible things that have happened to him instead of, you know, great successes. So the reason why that's significant is because if someone claiming to be the seed of Abraham, first of all, I think there's an increase in sort of the significance of titles here. And he chooses three titles, and there seems to be this three thing going on. You know, he has the mm-hmm. three titles, he has the third heaven, he has the three times he prays. It's just, I guess, probably for rhetorical effect. But I think there's an increase here in verse 22 where he says, are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the offspring of Abraham? Well, so am I. You know, it seems like he keeps increasing the identity, you know, politics game he's playing.
One would just be ethnic. The other would be, you know, again, covenantal. And then you get to the descendants of Abraham. That's a subset of the other one. So, yeah.
Right. And if you're familiar with Paul in other places, he's dealt with what it means to be the seed of Abraham, to be in Christ, and mm-hmm. how in Galatians 3, he's talked about the seed is Christ. And that was what's promised. And from my first podcast I did with you guys, you know, we talked about that, how Paul and other Second Temple Jews see the seed of Abraham promised to include the inheritance of the cosmos, to become like the stars, to become like the heavenly hosts, which would probably be the ascendant order here. It's not just the ethnic category. It's not just the covenantal category, but it's everything it means to be the seed of Abraham. And then naturally following that, a servant of the Messiah, seeing as he sees Messiah as the ultimate seed of Abraham. And so he's saying he's a better follower than any of the others who would claim to be followers of Messiah and boast in those things, that they are the seed of Abraham. But he doesn't use anything you'd expect someone to boast in. Mm-hmm. He only uses these horrible things. And that's the context in which we get this, him being almost sarcastic, carrying on the fool speech at the beginning of chapter 12, that I must go on boasting. You know, you can imagine him, you know, slinging his hands around being really sarcastic with this, you know, like, you know, I've been beaten to death. I've been left for dead. You know, all these horrible things have happened, but I'm going to just go on boasting, you know? So it's not exactly rhetorically setting you up for big success here.
Do you think there's a flip side to it? You know, as though not to draw this out of them, but do you think that those who would have been listening to this would be thinking, Paul in effect saying, well, let's hear how much you guys have suffered, you know, for the right thing. And this could also be a dig at them. Do you think there's a flip side to it?
Yeah, I definitely do. There is context for that in other speeches, and there is rhetorical one-uppings in Greek literature like this, where you know the one who is a greater fool for righteousness' sake than the other person. So there is some of that going. There's obviously that going on, but I think there's also this playing on the horrible things that have happened to him and attaching it to being a follower of Messiah.
Oh, it's genuine.
Yeah, it's genuine, and for real.
He's not making it up.
Right, exactly. But what it plays for him rhetorically, why it's so significant, is that I think what he's doing in the context of the passage, and this will be critical to the argument about what this ascent means, is and why he puts it there, is he frames it from coming as the true seed of Abraham, as the follower of the Messiah. So that these types of claims as being the seed of Abraham and the follower of Messiah, the best of all of them, it comes with all sorts of apocalyptic nuance. Because if Messiah has come and the revelation of Messiah is at hand and the end is at hand, which I think Paul is believing that eschatology has been inaugurated in the coming of Messiah. But it didn't come with any bombastic destruction of enemies, but quite the opposite, the suffering of the Messiah. And it's as a result of that, as a result of his suffering, as a result of his torment, this is what results in the Messiah's glorification, his resurrection, his ascendancy. So that is the vindication that comes.
That's really important.
Eschaton for him.
You know, with your last episode or a previous episode on the death of the gods, because the death of the gods, you know, victory, let's just use one word here. Victory is defined as bringing people into the body of Christ. And basically the trajectory for that is suffering, you know, on the part of those who are doing the work.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's not, you know, this Jewish expectation that, oh, the Messiah shows up now, all you guys are going to die. You know, all our enemies are going to die. Well, actually the way victory is achieved here is inverted. And I think, you know, you can see that pretty clearly. And also for our listeners, I think, you know, David's point about this crescendo leading up to the being a child of Abraham. You know, while it's true that within a lot of New Testament books, it's hard to figure out the chronological order of when they were written, this is 2 Corinthians, and it's definitely later than Galatians. So, you know, we don't have a problem with that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a much later, which is actually pretty important because when you've already wrote books like 1 Corinthians and you've written stuff like Galatians and depending on when you date Romans, it's interesting that he's already developed this theme of participation in the suffering of Christ, which results in vindication. I mean, hopefully Romans 8 would come to mind here, you know, that you suffer with Christ so that you may be glorified with him. You're crying out, Abba, Father, just as he did on the cross. So there's this assumption that once you're grafted in as a Gentile, or once you're baptized into him, into Christ and sharing the same spirit, that it's the ancient Mediterranean forms of like ultimate ethics, would be through mimesis, which is just copying, imitating, where we get the term imitate, the imitatio of Christ, imitatio Christi, the imitation of Christ. This is coming from Paul, which is part of a wider Mediterranean discourse on ethics. I mean, it seems to be very common that that's what you would do. A great philosopher, a great king, a great sage, you would mimic them to achieve the status that they've achieved. Well, in this case, Paul's mimicry is through suffering and boasting in weaknesses, because that's exactly how Christ was glorified. And that's how just past this ascent ends. So I guess we should get into the ascent now, yeah?
Yeah, well, I was going to say that this is not a trivial point, and I don't want to, I'm going to take you right back to where you want to launch in here. But
Yeah, go.
This, we have a very common notion in certain, you know, segments of the church today. Well, actually, I'll go with both segments, both sides of this. There's one, you know, side that sort of marries itself to the political left, and we get an entitlement thing and a service thing, which, you know, the service to others is really important, obviously a point of Christian ethics. But on the other side, we get this sort of conquest, you know, mentality, you know, where the church has to sort of take over society and reform it, clean it up. And I think what Paul's saying here is, this is not how you're going to win. This is not how you're going to win the world, you know, to take it over and sort of, not by violent force, but by political force, forcing it to be what, you know, ethically, theologically, you know, maybe Christianly, ecclesiastically, what you want it to be. You know, the path to victory here is being willing to suffer.
Yes.
And I personally think that that's something that the church has really lost, but I don't want to drift off into application here, but
no, I mean, that's the context here. Yeah. That is definitely the context, because the whole point of a fool's discourse like this is, there's multiple points to it, that he's got a lot of rhetorical goals that he's trying to achieve by it. But one, obviously, the defense of his apostleship. And one of the mainly, there's a number of reasons why he would have to defend himself, is keeping Gentiles and not making them Jews, calling them the seed of Abraham, and they're not even circumcised. But also his gospel. I mean, his gospel's pretty radical. The fact that you can say that the crucified Messiah is the Lord of the world, that he's the blessed one forever, the ascendant one at the right hand of God vindicated, is the one that the Romans killed. He didn't do any killing. It's quite the opposite, actually. He brought people back from the dead. So and that's how it ends. It ends with suffering, and then is vindicated with ascendancy and glorification and status. And so in the midst of this fool's thing, he goes on boasting, he goes into the ascent. Now, some traditional views about Paul's ascent, some recent monographs, there's one by James Buchanan Wallace called Snatched into Paradise, Paul's Heavenly Journey in the Context of Early Christian Experience, just sort of framing it as a reflection of early Christian suffering and sort of framing the ascent in that context. He has a pretty developed bibliography of all the ascent traditions in ancient Judaism and in the Greco-Roman world, and it's a pretty thorough monograph. There's others. There's one by Paula Gooder called Only the Third Heaven on Paul's ascent, saying that it was a failed ascent, and he didn't reach the heights. And it's, if I remember correctly, it's kind of like a polemic against those who would say they've gone to the heights. You know, it's like, oh, well, I failed. You know, I didn't make it all the way. You know, in the list of his failures, he's already listed. So that's an interesting view, but I don't think that's what's going on here. Another common view that I think you mentioned back in your Acts 22 podcast is the Merkava mysticism view, that it's like these later rabbinic sources that talk about the ascent of these four into pardes, into paradise, where you have Asher, the man who makes it. I don't necessarily think that's what's going on either, actually. I mean, I think the ascent to paradise as like the topos, or like the archetypical story, is obviously there all across the board. So in terms of genre, absolutely, without question, it's part of that same genre. And I actually think this would be for another time, but I actually think that some of those later Jewish rabbinic sources that are, I believe that's in the Talmud Bavli, I think that's in the Babylonian Talmud, is coming from interaction with these Christian sources. So that, and definitely, I think
Daniel, that would be interesting.
Yeah, Daniel Boyarin has spoken to this, famous Jewish Talmudic scholar, rabbinic scholar, and expert on Christian origins as well. He has spoken about the early Talmud with Asher and the Daniel 7 traditions as sort of arguing with Christological formations that have come in the church. And this is, I think a lot of scholars have done a good job of this, of showing that what we see in later rabbinic Judaism and the same in later Christianity as it develops, that these are not like broke up and never see each other, never talk to each other. You know, they're their completely own identity after the temple's destroyed. That's right. Just not the picture anymore. And critical scholarship has done a great job to show that the identities of these two groups are being formed over and against one another, in debate with one another, and wrestling even with scriptural traditions with one another. So I would not be surprised if the Pauline tradition of ascent isn't in play later in those conversations. But again, that's for another day. But what I think another interesting view is that, which also comes from later sources from the Talmud, is that David Litva, who we've spoken about before, has suggested that this is a Mosaic ascent story about how drawing on a tradition of how Moses' heavenly ascent and B Shabbat 88b through 89a, the early traditions of Moses' ascent to heaven and dominance over angels, that he had trouble ascending and angels didn't want him to ascend, and yet he ascended the heavenly mountain anyways, you know, to get the law. So there was pushback from the heavenly forces in his ascent, and which is also a later tradition, but it is interpreting earlier evidence. So it is probably an early tradition.
Do you think does Litwa do anything with some of the Second Temple stuff, you know, where Moses is, you know, given a seat, you know, next to, or in some cases, God's own seat for a while.
Oh, and Ezekiel the tragedian.
Yeah.
I don't remember if he brings that up in the article or not.
Yeah, because I mean, you could see it as being part of the picture. So there'd be threads to pick up there that would get picked up later, you know, in the later stuff. You would think anyway.
Yeah, he's got a lot of early rabbinic stuff in there. A little bit on from Philo. But mainly that one tractate that he sticks on. But the point being is there's a lot of different vantage points into the background of this material. But I think many of them fail to take into account the actual rhetorical context of the fool speech. So they kind of treat the ascent vision as sort of, you know, they want to focus just on the ascent stories that could function as the background. And I think they miss one that I think may be the background here. And it's the ascent of Abraham. Even in some of the bigger monographs, there is like a sort of mention of Abraham's ascent to heaven and Apocalypse of Abraham. Wallace has a section on that, but it doesn't sort of function archetypically for the whole story for him. But why I think there may be an ascent of Abraham as the background here is because of the appeal to being the seed of Abraham, the best follower of Christ. That sort of sets the tone for the trajectory of this whole speech and the inclusion of the ascent.
So essentially you're saying when his listeners or readers would have seen the reference to the seed of Abraham, if they're familiar with this, with that Second Temple text, they're going to put two and two together.
Right. And not even the Second Temple text itself, but I'm going to show that this is a pretty wide tradition that goes beyond the Second Temple text. So yes, they could be familiar with where the first place I'll go is the Apocalypse of Abraham to demonstrate this, this tradition. But it goes all the way into early rabbinic literature as well, in Genesis Rabbah, which is part of the Midrash Rabbah, of early Jewish Midrash, dating somewhere probably, if I remember correctly, 3rd century CE. So you'll see that this tradition lasts a long time, because a similar way of reading Genesis 15, which I've talked about, you know, before on the podcast, this similar way of reading it seems to go a long ways into rabbinic tradition, and seems to formulate how someone would go back and think, what does it mean to be the seed of Abraham? Because that's really what Paul is already doing. He says, okay, if you want to boast in something, I can too. I'm a Hebrew. I'm an Israelite. I'm the seed of Abraham as well. And even includes an ascent tradition. So I want to suggest that rhetorically, this ascent tradition is coming from this Abrahamic ascent where he gets the promise of seed. And so it would be very interesting if this is the case. So I'm sort of putting it over as a hypothesis, and I'm going to be presenting this, a paper on the topic, at this year's SBL.
If the dating, you know, I mean, Charlesworth assigns a date to the Apocalypse of Abraham, first or second century. I mean, it's roughly contemporaneous. I mean, you could probably be fair and say that much, you know, with what Paul's writing here. So, you know, yeah. it could be anyway. So, you know,
that's true. It is very, very old. And my supervisor at Marquette, Andre Orlov, is also an expert in this text and has written an absurd amount of literature on it. But he said that probably dates anywhere from 1st century BCE to 1st century CE.
Oh, wow.
So it's because they give it a Palestinian provenance. So it's more than likely a Palestinian apocalypse, which makes it very interesting because it would be part of the early Jewish apocalyptic, not from the diaspora, but even though these ascent traditions that go out into the diaspora via apocalyptic can all be traced back to sort of, you know, early Palestinian stuff. And it goes on into later Palestinian stuff in rabbinic literature. So that makes it really interesting, and I think sort of adds more chips to in the game that this may be more significant than we think.
Yeah, and for listeners, again, we on this podcast assume that, you know, you might want to be sitting down when you hear this, but we assume that Paul read books. Okay. we assume that Paul read things. And again, if Orlov is correct here, and you know, he does work in Slavonic, you know, he's one of the few people who really, because that's his own heritage, you know, that part of the world, Eastern Europe. So if he's right in moving this back into the BC orbit, then this very well could have been something Paul would have read. You know, in other words, he's an informed person. He's an academic, you know, for his day. So it's not much of a stretch.
Yeah. I think another important point, Mike, that we've covered before when I've been on your podcast is that we have to remember what texts for the most part actually are in the ancient world. I mean, yes, they ascribe all sort of, you know, inspirational significance to biblical texts and things like that. But we have to remember that they're also maybe first and foremost and primarily perhaps a preservation of traditions. So you don't, you know, if you want traditions to last, first of all, it's expensive and difficult, and there's not tons of scribes. They're a very small bunch. You write things down. Mm-hmm. And so traditions that would have been more prevalent would have been written down. And it's obviously prevalent enough to be kept by the church in its early apocalyptic traditions and preserved. And so it's not only that it was written down, but it was significant enough to early Christian theology that they are the ones that preserved it, coming out of that Jewish apocalyptic tradition. So again, I think it's particularly difficult for Protestants sometimes to think about the fact that sometimes texts are preservation of tradition, not the other way around. not like, because yes, they produce traditions in and of themselves, and sometimes we want to question those later traditions and go back to earlier ones, but the texts themselves preserve early traditions that predate it. And so that, just that as sort of looking at texts as sort of archaeological evidence of sorts is important when we look at that, when we look at this, like evidence of traditions. And the reason why this particular one that I'm going to be drawing on is so significant is because of the, again, the stretch of the dates. So when you have early literature in Palestine that shows it, and then much later literature that is, it has similar sort of tradition, more than likely it's pretty widespread. You know, more than likely there's enough Jews that think this way, and then even later Christians that think this way, that it's worth preserving. So basically my argument is going to be that it may be a better background to go to these ascent of Abraham traditions as a background for 2 Corinthians 12 than some of the others. And I think once we get into them, you'll see why. So the first text where we see this tradition pop up is one I've mentioned before, the Apocalypse of Abraham that we've talked about. And you find it in chapter 20. Just before chapter 20, you see the context here is Abraham's has been taken up to heaven in a heavenly journey. And this is an interpretation of what's happened to him in Genesis 15, where you have the word of Yahweh coming to him and then taking him outside, mm-hmm. and him behold the heavens, you know, behold the stars, number them. So they take the Apocalypse of Abraham, obviously, is part of this long-standing tradition, because there's just enormous amounts of material that's added to the biblical text, just tons of material. But it's rooted in that story of him being taken out. So, and that verb that's used there in 15 is used in apocalyptic literature as well. And we'll see in the later rabbinic literature, the idea that he's not just taken outside of his tent or something like, hey, come outside and, you know, look up. It's, they actually take it as him taken outside the actual cosmos itself to the heights of heaven. So he's taken out of the world as we know it into the heights of heaven, which would literally be tiered, you know, like we've talked about before on the podcast. And in this case of Apocalypse of Abraham, he's up in the eighth tier of heaven. So he's just about as high as you can go. And I don't remember how many tiers there are in Apocalypse of Abraham, either 8 or 10, but he's up in the eighth.
I have the Apocalypse of Abraham open here, and just for the, again, for the sake of the listeners, in a section or chapter 21 begins, it says, "And he, God, said to me," again, Abraham, you know, is the speaker, "Look now beneath your feet at the firmament and understand the creation that was depicted of old." So, you know, what David is describing, that's right out of the text here.
Yeah, he's literally above the firmament. So in chapter 20, "The Eternal Mighty One said to me," it starts. And mm-hmm. the Eternal Mighty One is this figure, and this is very clear that Apocalypse of Abraham, amongst many other texts, as we'll see, the Eternal Mighty One is this word of Yahweh figure who comes to Abraham in Genesis 15. Mm-hmm. So these aren't just some sort of prophetic word that comes to him, and it's a person, it's a figure. In this mm-hmm. text, the Eternal Mighty One. So the Eternal Mighty One has taken him on this journey, like the great angel tradition or this second power that we've talked about before, as a background to early Christology. But here in this text, we'll just focus on it. It says, "The Eternal Mighty One said to him," and this is in the context, remember, of him being taken outside. It says, "Abram, Abraham, Abraham. And I said, here I am. And he said, look from on high at the stars which are beneath you and count them for me and tell me their number." So again, we see the taking him outside and looking at the stars.
Really outside.
Yeah, he's not just outside. He's outside the firmament. And so this taking him outside and the looking down, habet, can be taken as, which is, this is probably where it's coming from. The Hebrew can actually easily be taken that way. It can mean from looking from up to down. It's used that way in the Proverbs. So when you pair that with being taken out, and looking down and seeing the stars. That's one way. That is an actual legitimate translation of the Hebrew. It's really interesting that they would interpret that. Well, clearly this is an apocalypse. Now, mind you, Genesis says that Abraham was a prophet. Obviously, he's seen the whole Exodus. You know, he's seen his seed. He's seen the 400 years. He's promised the he's seen the conquest. He's seen all that stuff in Genesis 15. So much so that later traditions would say he's seen the end, you know, like the apocalypse of Abraham and others. And even in the Gospel of John, you have Jesus saying, Abraham has seen my day and rejoiced. Mm-hmm. And so there's this tradition that a lot more was revealed to him than we think, even eschatologically.
So you're saying, you know, Abraham has seen my day, that very well could be a, you know, for us, cryptic reference to Abraham has seen my coming, you know, essentially my incarnation and what I'm about to do and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And
that's interesting.
And incorporating it into the whole narrative, because I don't want to get off on John right now, but if we were to go to that, you'd have to say, well, new creation there, conquest of the powers, all that kind of stuff would be included in that. So in the day, because, you know, when you think of what Abraham was actually saw and what he was actually promised, even in his deep sleep, just in the context of that vision in Genesis 15, he saw he was promised the coming Exodus, the conquest of the lands, and that's the end of Torah. He's seen the end of Torah. And for many Jews, especially in the Second Temple period, we have enormous evidence for this, especially in Josephus, we're reading the Torah eschatologically. And so the Torah is sort of the framework of all of history. It's not just ends just before the conquest. It's that within Torah encapsulated the history of the world. So if Abraham has seen sort of the ends of that, then he must have seen the end of the world, especially when you have the prophets, when they talk about the eschaton, it's a new Exodus, you know, it's a new conquest of the powers. Sure. So there, it would be perfectly normal, actually, in the apocalyptic tradition to assume that Abraham must have saw the end. So that's really significant. Now, anyways, back to the text itself. So he says, the angel says to him, look from on high at the stars which are beneath you and count them for me and tell me their number. So again, Abraham is above the stars. He's been taken up above them in the heights. And then Abraham responds. He says, and I said, when can I? For I am a man. Now, I don't remember if we talked about that tradition or not. Why would Abraham ask that question? You know, how can I count them? You know, I'm just a man. Well, you know, an obvious answer might be, well, obviously, have you seen the stars? You know, you'd die before you count them all. Well, yeah, that may be the case. But if you know, but again, this is playing off these traditions from the Hebrew Bible. And in our Old Testaments, in the Hebrew Bible, we find the only time where, and you know this from my thesis, Mike, is the only time where we see that combination of numbering the host of heaven and the stars, or numbering and the stars, is actually from Yahweh himself. That Yahweh, in Psalm 148, in Isaiah 40, he numbers the heavenly host, he calls them all by name, he knows their number. You know, so this is something that the divine general, the divine vizier, knows his whole armies, you know, his whole host before him. He counts them all, their ranks that move before him. So that's the idea. So if you know those texts and you're reading or you're hearing Apocalypse of Abraham, then, you know, that's a legitimate question. You know, if the Eternal Mighty One's telling them to number the stars and he's like, how can I? I'm just a man. So this is a divine task. Now, and this is how the Eternal Mighty One responds to him. He said, and he said to me, as the number of the stars and their power, so shall I place for your seed the nations and men set apart for me and my lot with Azazel. So now this is very interesting. The promise of star-like seed here is being interpreted not just numerically, like we covered before, but qualitatively, becoming like them, having their power. But it's a specific power that's being talked about here. And this is important because this is showing how early Jews are reading the fulfillment of the covenant to Abraham, or the promise to Abraham in Paul's language, is that its power over the seed has power over nations and men that were set apart from me and my lot with Azazel. So Azazel being the chief of demons tradition, we talked about this from First Enoch in this text and others. So the chief of these evil forces, these heavenly hosts that are over these nations and men allotted to them. Again, we're seeing that Deuteronomy 32 worldview here. We're seeing the Psalm 82 worldview. When Abraham is seeing that he will be victorious over them, and his seed will actually inherit the rule over them. This is what we see from the inheritance of the nations promised to Abraham. This is how they're interpreting it. It's ultimately a victory over Azazel and the and those in lot with Azazel. So these spirits. So that's coming right out of the Deuteronomy 32 worldview. Now, the reason why this is so important is because in the ascent, the whole point of taking Abraham to the heights of heaven and above these stars, above these heavenly hosts, is to promise them their power, and it will happen through victorious conquest, and they will achieve nations and men, those that were given to allotted to Azazel and him. So this is really important, because this sets up the ascent tradition at this connects the ascent tradition with the seed of Abraham. And this is
drawn on Paul. Yeah, with the line in chapter 11. Yeah.
Right. So when you read, because you remember there's no chapters and verses in these letters, right? It's just the paragraphs. So when you're reading in context of the fool's speech as a whole, you set it up as, well, what someone would boast in is being the seed of Abraham with the Messiah, the inheritor of all the nations, those that were given to Azazel and the spirits of his lot, or Satan and his spirits. You know, that those traditions, these types of stories, like the ascent of Abraham here in the apocalypse of Abraham, are being told and retold and retold as etiologies or origin stories for the destiny of Israel, that the true Israel, the true seed of Abraham, are going to inherit the world. We're going to be victorious over our enemies. And these are used to buttress revolutionary traditions. So apocalypses, in one sense, these revelatory stories, as many scholars have pointed out, are more than likely germinate and grow as sort of anti-imperial type stories, where you tell about these sort of ascent traditions where they're promised victory over the powers. Well, you're looking forward to one day being over these nations that rule over you, you know, that have abused you. And actually, it's quite common in the Old Testament to use thorn in this way, that we'll see later, as a sort of image for the nations, and because it's part of the curse in Genesis. But this idea that one day that will end, these powers will be destroyed and victorious, you know, we'll tear them to pieces, and we'll inherit what was promised to the seed of Abraham from the beginning. So when you start out your fool speech boasting about, well, I'm the true seed of Abraham and I'm a follower of the Messiah, so Messiah is supposed to be the one that secures these victories, and you as the seed of Abraham, guess what? You get to inherit it all. And in many cases in apocalyptic literature, they participate in the divine warfare in the end. A good example of that is the War Scrolls from Qumran.
Yeah, the final day. Yeah,
The final day. Great battle.
It's important to point out that the militaristic talk is always associated with the Day of the Lord. It's not present at this point, you know, in Paul, you know, because he's saying the path to this victory is quite different.
Yeah, very different.
Yeah.
So that's one tradition you have of Abraham's ascent to heaven from Genesis 15. Now, fast forward a couple hundred years now, and you have in Genesis Rabbah, a rabbinic text. Now the way these midrash works, the way Jewish midrash works, I like how John Levinson from Harvard University talks about midrash to his students. He says, when you're normally comparing ways of interpreting texts, you always look for a referent outside of itself, you know? So like, it's like this, right? And whenever he's talking about Midrash, he's like, well, Midrash is like, well, It's Midrash. You know, he's like, there's not something else generally that it's easily comparable to, because it will incorporate, well, for starters, it's not just a commentary the way we think about commentaries in the Protestant world. You know, you have a pastor buys a commentary on a text. Mm-hmm. Well, Midrash doesn't really work that way. It is a collection of commentary on biblical literature, but it's more than just commentary. And they include all kinds of different rabbis in these texts. So you have a collection of rabbis in the Midrash where they'll have sometimes competing interpretations of a text, mm-hmm. but you codify them together because the conversation or the debate over the text is actually part of the process. That's part of the way of reading scripture in the Jewish tradition. And so in this Midrash, you have a number of rabbis who are discussing this text that we're talking about, Genesis 15, and interpret it in really interesting ways. Now, if you're looking for the reference, this is from Genesis Rabbah 44:12, and the text says, "And he brought him forth without," so, or taking him out, you know, in Genesis 15, 5. It's
It would be without, as in outside. Again, yeah, for the audience.
Bringing him forth without, taking him out.
Hebrew chutz. So.
Chutzah is the form here. "And Rabbi Joshua said in Rabbi Levi's name, 'Did he then lead him forth without the world?' That it says, 'And he brought him forth without?'" It means, it's pretty funny how they question this stuff. "It means, however, that he showed him the streets of heaven, as you read, while as yet he had not made the earth nor the outer spaces," chuzot, from Proverbs 8:26. Mm-hmm. So he makes a connection. This one rabbi, Rabbi Joshua and Rabbi Levi's name, makes a connection with Proverbs 8 saying, well, chuzot used there is made the earth and the outer spaces. So he must be in those outer spaces, just like it's mentioned there in Proverbs. So this is one way. It's called Gezerah Shavah in the rabbinic tradition, where you find a word from elsewhere in the Hebrew Bible, and you're looking to compare it or to elucidate what a verse means in another place that has that same word. And it's not just that simple. I think some people talk about it that simply, but normally there's some contextual reference why you would do that. For example, here, the context of Proverbs 8 is in the creation, making the outer, not just the earth, but at the outer spaces. So that's significant why he would draw on that comparison of chuzot. So when he's being taken without, it's literally taken out and seen the streets of heaven. Then another rabbi says, Rabbi Judah ben Rabbi Simon, or the son of Rabbi Simon, said in Rabbi Yohanan's name. So these are rabbis preserving earlier rabbinic tradition, which is also very significant because it predates the text. So it says, this rabbi says, "He lifted him up above the vault of heaven. Hence he says to him, 'Look, Habet,' now toward heaven." Habet signifying to look down from above.
Well, that sounds an awful lot like Apocalypse of Abraham right there.
Doesn't it? It sounds just like it. And this is hundreds of years later.
Yeah, it takes him above the firmament, says look down at the firmament. Yeah,
look down from above. So this is Abraham's ascent to literally rabbis. Now, you know, you would think some people have said, you know, rabbis, they don't do apocalyptic anymore. Those apocalyptic traditions died off. Well, Daniel Boyarin and lots of other scholars have showed that that's not true. And here's another rabbinic text showing that's not true. Clearly here, they're reading this Abrahamic tradition of being taken outside as literal ascent to heaven, literal apocalypse here. This is really significant, I think. I get excited about this nerdy stuff. All right, so he said, the rabbi says, Habet, signifying to look down from above. The rabbis said, plural, God said to him, "Thou art a prophet, not an astrologer, as it says, now therefore restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet." Genesis 27. So that's really interesting how this one rabbi is using the other rabbis that say, look, he's a prophet, not an astrologer. You know, so in other words, the astrologers, they look up at the heavens, right? Like, they look up and try to determine the fates by them. But Abraham's not like those. He's taken way up above them all.
Yeah, so he's not looking up. He's looking down.
Yeah, he's looking down at those suckers. Like, he's literally above them. Now, if you think about this with ancient, we don't live in a patriarchal culture as much anymore. Still a little bit, but not as much. And so we don't really think in terms of hierarchies as much, unless you're, you know, part of a, you know, company, government, whatever. Mm-hmm. But here you got to think of it in terms of hierarchy is significant ontologically, meaning what are you? Who are you really? Because if you can go up above the host that people look at to try to determine the fates, and you're a tier above them, then you're something else entirely, right? I mean, mm-hmm. This is ontologically, you've sort of exceeded them, you know, in their power. So this is not some regular astrology story we're talking about here, in other words. So it goes on to say, in the days of Jeremiah, the Israelites wished to entertain this belief in astrology, but the Holy One, blessed be He, would not permit them. Thus it is written, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so then Rabbi Levi says, while the sandal is on your foot, this is, watch what this rabbi says. This is fascinating. It says, the rabbi said, while the sandal is on your foot, tread down the thorn. He who is placed below them fears them, but thou, Abraham, art placed above them, so trample them down. Hmm. Now that is interesting, isn't it?
the thorn language there, yeah.
The thorn language. While the sandal is on your foot, tread down the thorn. Now, what? Remember the context of the sort of rabbinic conversation going on here about Genesis 15:5. When he's taken out, they've already established he's in the heavens. He's mm-hmm. in the halls of heaven, you know. He's above the stars. He's above the firmament. He's looking down at them. And so he's not a regular astrologer. He's not like these other Israelites who went astray and did that. He's above that, all that. So much so that this rabbi says, the sandal on your foot is treading down the thorn.
Mm-hmm. You're walking. You're basically wiping your feet on the powers.
Exactly. Yeah. So they go theological with this,
yeah.
And they're saying, okay, how we characterize these powers, because it is a them. They're the singular thorn here is like a metaphor for the powers. Mm-hmm. Who are over the people who fear
the stars were considered divine beings, divine powers.
Exactly.
So there you go. You know, so yeah. So Abraham is the one who essentially puts or has, I don't know what the correct verb would be here, but probably both, puts or has the powers underfoot. You know, mm-hmm. He has his foot on their neck, so to speak, if we could use that image.
Yeah. Exactly. The image is the treading underfoot is always, it's a Hebraism for defeat of foes. Mm-hmm. You know, you see it in Zechariah with the Messiah does.
I guess toward the end of Romans, you know, it's not that, you know, the whole passage about, you know, having Satan under your feet or.
Yeah. Romans 16.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not that, you know, Jesus is going to do that. He's speaking to the Romans. He's speaking to believers.
Yeah. For the participatory
otherwise known as the children of Abraham. Yeah.
Bingo. So they have the same traditions. Like, this is not new. This is not New Testament stuff. This is Jewish rabbinic stuff, apocalyptic and rabbinic stuff. Now, what's so fascinating about it is the trampling them down is, well, obviously the forces aren't trampled down when he gets up there. They're still there. But that's the point, is this is an apocalypse. It's a revealing of something in the future. And so when people are going to these stories, you got to think, how do these stories function for people? Because when we're talking about a rhetorical context that's significant with Paul here in this text, we have to think, how do these texts function? How do these stories about Abraham ascending to heaven, promise victory over the forces, you know, looking down at them, exalted over them, trampling them underfoot, inheriting the rule from the you know, evil powers, you know, mm-hmm. trampling the thorn. How does that function? I mean, why do you even tell those stories? The reason you tell those stories is because you're giving hope to the current generation who's hearing them that you, being the seed of Abraham, this is your destiny. You will trample them underfoot. This leads to a lot of sort of, it gives you privilege, right? I mean, if you're the group of people out of all the groups of people in under the heavens who are the seed of this guy, who are promised to rule eternally, then guess what? You've got some reason to boast. I mean, you're literally going to trample down all the powers that rule over everybody else. So basically, you're not just better than everybody else. You're like way better than everybody else. Well, and I think that's how some of these apocalyptic stories function with people in early Judaism, is they're used to say, yeah, death to all the Gentiles, you know?
Well, I mean, it's also useful to you know, telling people, you know, stop thinking about your current circumstance. I mean, this circumstance that you're experiencing is the temporary one. You know, it's this world is not your home, you know, kind of thing. You know, and if they're conscious of, you know, a future destiny that transcends where they're at this point,
right? I mean,
that matters. You know, that matters.
Absolutely.
That's the thing you're living for, not your current circumstance, or at least it should be.
And it's not just to get out of the circumstance and have victory over the powers that will do it. Because for Paul, it's not getting out of it. It's actually participating in the suffering itself. And so it's interesting when he
participating in the process. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Because the irony is that the process, that is the process.
Right.
You know, and I think for listeners, you know, if you just think of the old famous quote, I don't know who said it, but the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. You know, it's this idea that it's through suffering that the church actually wins.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
Whereas we're it's through marketing. You know, it's through it's through all this other. You know, it's through being clever. You know, it's using earthly powers. You know, to advance the cause of the church. You know, no, it's none of that stuff really. You know, that is what Paul's saying.
Yeah,
it's none of that stuff.
Exactly. So when you actually see him to the third heaven, which for him, contra gooder here, in my opinion, is it would be the heights of heaven, the high heavens, whether in body or out of the body, I don't know. God knows, he says. That's very interesting. He doesn't really know what that situation is. So it could be an apocalyptic vision, you know, or it could be like a physical ascent. He's not sure. Mm-hmm. But the man being caught up into paradise is him. You talked about that before. Mm-hmm. So he's been to paradise like these other texts. And you know, it's important for listeners who haven't heard other podcasts, perhaps, to know that when we think of paradise, this is an important divine council concept as well. When you think of the heights of the cosmic mountain where the gods meet, this is always the paradise area. This is where the seat of the waters, you know, the source of the waters in the Psalms, or where you have the rivers coming down from Eden, the mountain of God, you know, the meeting point of all the fresh water, you know, the place of life, the place with beautiful, you know, paradise. This is where we get the Hanging Gardens in Babylon concept, is like, you know, Marduk's temple is up there at the top, and it's this great paradise atop the cosmic mountain. It's the same type of idea. So if you've been to the heights of heaven, guess what? You've been to paradise where the gods are. I mean, you can't get higher, basically. So that's why I think this is definitely an accomplished apocalypse. And he even talks about it like it's accomplished. He's definitely made it to the heights. And he heard things that cannot be told, which man cannot utter. I know you've talked about the tongues of angels stuff before. Mm-hmm. Don't need to go into that. But it's in that context where he says, on behalf of this man I'll boast, but on my own behalf I will not boast except of my weaknesses. So this is the deal. It's still in the context of that fool speech. Though if I should wish to boast, I would not be a fool. So he brings it up again, even after his ascent. Like, I'm still talking as a fool here. You know, I know you would normally attribute these ascents as a great victory. Now, if the Abrahamic story is here, like being the seed of Abraham. Don't you remember when Abraham ascended and he was promised victory over, you know, the Azazel or Satan figure and all the spirits of his lot? He tramples them underfoot. If you have that in mind, and then you hear this in verse 7 when he says, so to keep me from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, which Paul's here for a minute, he's not saying that it's not great. It's not amazing. It's not real apocalypse like he's really been. Paul is for sure a Jewish mystic apocalypticist. There's no getting around that. When you picture Paul, don't picture just the, you know, the erudite sort of scribe studying in a school. Picture the crazy apocalyptic mystic as well, because that's what he is.
It's a little bit of both.
he is both for sure. Like, I mean, he's like, yes, the greatness of the revelations, it's surpassing. So he's definitely harping on that. But he says, in the context of that, and this is the key, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from being conceited. So that now thorn here is interpreted all kinds of different ways. What I think is going on, if this tradition is in the background, like we saw in Genesis Rabbah, the thorn is just another metaphor for these powers who the people under heaven fear, right? But he can trample them underfoot. Well, a thorn was given in my flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me. Now, this in my flesh thing is significant from, again, keep it within the fool speech. These other people boast in their flesh, right? They boast in their flesh. Like, we're Hebrews, we're Israelites, we are the descendants of Abraham. This is it. So they're boasting in their flesh. They're ones who would take ascendancy. They would take domination. And in context of Paul's defense of his apostleship, they would see themselves as greater than him. You know, he's not a legitimate apostle. We are greater than him. So he's using things that you would boast in your flesh about, but his boast is this torment that was given to him, to harass him, to torment him from an angel of Satan. So I think here the thorn is the angel of Satan. So one of these powers that those who under heaven fear, because in the midst of his ascent, he is not trampling them down, that he's actually being tormented by this thorn. Right. So this shows he's not using his ascent story the way you would typically use an ascent story to talk about the dominance over these others that are promised, the trampling underfoot, the looking down on them. Is he still being tormented, even though he said, I'm following the Messiah, the truth, and I'm the seed of Abraham?
I mean, that is the,
you see it?
The mimesis, as you know, the term you used earlier, the template for the Messiah.
Exactly.
Because the you know, Jesus, of course, knows what the destiny is, but he also knows he has to go through the torment first. And so he's actually mimicking, you know, he's mimicking, the, you know, Christ very...
Exactly. Because what do you have in the Jesus tradition? And there may even be some of the early Jesus tradition behind this. I'm not sure. But what you have in Jesus' tradition, when they're celebrating his, you know, coming into Jerusalem, you know, and he finally is there at the Mount of Olives, and especially in Luke, you have literally Satan is there tempting him, tormenting him. Like in the end, Satan is literally there and present in the story. And all narrative gospel scholars have made an important point that the temptation stories from Satan in the beginning are intended to rhetorically mirror the temptation in the garden when Satan is there, especially in Luke. So the idea of Jesus being tormented by Satan and then dying, but then ascendant and glorified as a result of his suffering, not through it, not ending it, but as a result of his suffering unto death, he's exalted. So I think there's definitely maybe some sort of echoes of the torment by Satan and then overcoming it even through suffering. So this is what Paul is seeking to boast in. So the thorn here, again, I think is a reference to the angel of Satan. Now, this does not mean that there isn't physical ailments attached to it. There is enormous amounts of Greek literature that talk about, including Jewish literature, that ailments are attached with demonic possession, or a spirit has an malevolent spirit has come, and as a result, someone's blind, or as a result, they have stomach issues, or whatever.
Right. It doesn't have to be an either or. It's a
this is not an either. Yeah, and so he probably has some physical ailment that he's rooting this in, and maybe he thinks it's come as a result of this ascent that he has experienced. So That being said, it's not an either or. These debates and articles about either or are kind of silly to me. But I definitely do think what he's doing with this thorn is he's using it metaphorically to speak of the angel himself that's tormenting him. And the fact is, it's to keep him from being conceited. Again, this is the whole purpose of the passage. This is the whole rhetorical point, because the Lord actually said to me, even though he said he wasn't going to talk about the ascent, he still says what the Lord said. You know, it's funny. But my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. It is not made perfect in trampling out the powers underfoot. That's not how it's done. It's this sort of, it's the power that's granted to unending fidelity. Because when you see in the Christ tradition with Jesus, he's faithful unto the end. You know, even in the great temptation, take this cup from me, but not my will be done, your will be done. Right. So he doesn't want to suffer the great suffering, but if it's faithfulness unto the Father, he'll do it, even to the bitter end. And so it's like, this is how the power is made perfect. It's through weakness. It is not through the violent destruction of his enemies, because just as Christ said, you know, I could call down legions of angels to destroy all these people that are killing him. So it's the same sort of idea. It's therefore I'll boast more gladly of my weaknesses so that the power of Messiah may rest upon me. See, sharing with the weaknesses of Messiah so that the power of Messiah can rest on him. This is how the ultimate inheritance and power is achieved. It is not through the demise and destruction of the thorns. It is willing to go through the torment in order for God to glorify, which is part of the Abrahamic story too. The one who leaves everything, basically dying to himself, God exalts and makes a great nation and gives a great name.
Yeah, so, it's God's victory anyway.
Exactly.
So and if you want to, you know, again, it's a template. You know, you want to participate. I hate to use the word play the game, but if you want to, you know, if you want to play the game the way it's supposed to be played, you play it like Jesus played it. You know, and that's the way you actually win.
Right.
You know, not again, I don't want to use that to be flippant about it, but it's patterning, you know, and I think, again, there are going to be some, maybe not necessarily in, you know, what I consider sort of the native podcast, as Trey would say, the naked nation here, you know, who would buy into this idea of, well, we need to go out there and look for demons and cast them out and confront. This is exactly the opposite. This is the opposite. And for those who have read, you know, my fiction, I'll just call your mind back to not the very end scene, but close to the end scene with Sabi. This is precisely the tactic. This is precisely the tactic. You don't assume to confront, you know, in the case of the story and in the case of the passage, a divine power. You are willing to suffer because you know that it's going to lead to its demise anyway. You know, it's the same kind of idea. So if you can think of those analogies, that's what David's getting at here. It inverts again, sort of what pop Christianity, you know, would sort of assume, you know, that we're supposed to go out there and, you know, confront as many demons as we. And again, the point is not that you never try to deliver someone, you know, because, you know, we have those stories too, you know, in the Gospels and even in Paul's case as well. It's an assumption of exaltation that I think we need to be really, really careful about.
Yeah. And that's the whole point, is if this Abrahamic tradition is behind it, and I'm still raising it more as a question than some sort of dogmatic stance, but it makes sense of all the parts of being the seed of Abraham, yet at the ascendance, the thorn is sent against him instead of him trampling underfoot, which the whole point of this tradition, it goes to back up exactly what you're saying, is that the usurpation of hostile heavenly forces in victory is being flipped to an ascent that results in torment. And that is exactly what Paul is attempting to do to those who would doubt his apostleship, you know, for his apparent failings, or those who would suffer, who claim to follow this Messiah that Paul is preaching. It's saying that you're not the seed of Abraham just because you're victorious over the powers. It's quite the opposite. It's that you are truly the best, because he says he's the best. He follows Messiah the best. And again, he's just speaking rhetorically. He's saying that because this is the way. This is the best way. You really want to follow Christ? Okay, come and be willing. Open yourself up to this, because what happens is, in Paul's mind, it's totally redefining the Messiah event. We can't say this definitively because we don't have all the evidence. We don't know if many people believe in suffering Messiah. Some people say the Gabriel stone or something does that. We don't really know. But what we can know for sure is what this would have done would be pretty subversive to those who would use these ascent traditions as sort of the bombastic trample your enemies underfoot sort of tradition. It's the exact opposite of what Paul's doing here. And he can bring it upon himself. Notice he's not talking about anybody else. He's saying, yeah, an angel was sent to torment me. Yeah, great Paul, huh? The best follower of Messiah? Well, I'm sitting here in torment, you know? So it's obviously greatness is being redefined here. It's not lording it. This is the same sort of tradition we find at the end of the Gospels as well. Jesus says, you know, how do the Gentiles do it? They lord it over you. But how did I come to you? As a servant, you know, as a slave. So it's the same kind of thing we're seeing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the inversion is really, yeah, I mean, that's significant. Because, it's by this inversion that victory will emerge on the other side. But, and it goes, you know, with Paul talking, you know, earlier in the epistle about, you know, the foolishness of the cross and just this whole idea that the preaching of the cross is foolishness to this, that, and the other group, you know, and mm-hmm. it's quite in line, you know, with that, because it's almost like it's intentionally not supposed to look like what it is.
Yeah.
You know, which I kind of like stuff like that, you know,
which is apocalyptic. Yeah, I mean, right. That's the core of apocalyptic.
You think you're losing everything, but right. Again, if you're
not seeing behind the curtain.
Right. If you take the path and you know you're confident in what is behind the curtain, even though you're not seeing it, you'll get to the point where you do see it, and you'll find out that this was the way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you took the time to A, get into it, and B, you know, share it with us here on the podcast. You know, I know the drill here. You know, we try to, you know, read the text in context. And I think this is, you've got a number of trajectories here that are really worth thinking about. So when you're going to read a paper, what specifically, just sort of this overview or one aspect of it, what's the paper going to be on in November?
Well, it has one of those obtuse titles that you love to make fun of me for. So, but it's Ascent and Torment, the apocalyptic juxtaposition of an Abrahamic victorious ascent trope.
Okay.
And so, but basically I'm just trying to say that it's sort of a reverse apocalyptic. Mm-hmm. So it's focusing on the Abrahamic, zooming in on the Abrahamic ascent tradition as the primary background to this. And so drawing on the sort of identity politics on claiming seed of Abraham, mm-hmm. and rhetorically attaching it to this Abrahamic ascent tradition, which would reveal that Paul is intentionally and actively trying to flip something over, you know, for rhetorical effect.
When the conference in November, we can catch up with you after, you know, you do the paper.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you've got any good questions afterwards, you can let us know. You can share.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll do it.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for spending the time with us.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
We'll certainly have found it interesting. Again, this is what we try to do here. We try to read the text in context. And again, trying to get the first century reader, you know, the first century person in your head to help you understand what Paul was trying to communicate.
And good luck in Wisconsin, David.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, still packing like crazy. This is not fun part.
Yeah, I don't envy you. Yeah, well, thanks again for spending the time with us.
Yeah, thanks, Cass.
Yep, absolutely. Bye-bye.
All right, see y'all. Bye-bye.
All right, Mike, another great conversation with David Burnett.
Yeah, very interesting again. I mean, David spends a lot of time in Second Temple material, and so it's a good balance to the Semitic stuff. I mean, I know I get into it once in a while, but that's where he lives most of the time. So glad to have him.
Sounds good. And next week, Mike, we'll be doing our 22nd Q&A show. So be looking out for that. And I guess, Mike, with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.